You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Today on the show, we have John Collins. And John Collins is the author and webmaster of William Branham, Historical Research. He was born and raised in The Message, a cult following of William Branham. And he's the grandson of Willard Collins, former pastor of William Branham's Branham Tabernacle in Jefferson, Indiana. From 1976 to 2012, John was unduly influenced to believe and to practice many of the religious and cultural views expressed by William Branham and by men and women who were in Branham's inner circle. After his escape in 2012, John began the process of deprogramming from the indoctrinated religious and worldviews Branham expressed on recorded sermons from 1947 to 1965. And this process included reevaluating every aspect of life, including personal experiences and beliefs that were core to his belief system, his worldview, and his personality. In the early stages of this re-evaluation, John's worldview was centered around indoctrinated apocalyptic theology that resulted from William Branham's focus on doomsday through either doomsday predictions or alleged doomsday prophecies. As a result, early research focused upon differences between Branham's theological views and that of evangelical or fundamentalist Christianity, with the intent to categorize Branham's doctrines into categories of biblical, extra-biblical, and anti-biblical. Once establishing the baseline for religious views, John began to research the historical life events of William Branham. Branham's life story was integrated into the religious views as core theology in The Message, due to William Branham's usage of his accounts as the foundation for many doctrines expressed in his recorded sermons. While focused primarily upon William Branham, it was necessary to also research the men associated with or influential to Branham, as well as notable events in the historical timeline of United States and world history. And when this research was organized chronologically, John began to notice patterns of data that appeared to suggest strategic usage of Pentecostal and fundamentalist extremism to advance the political views of men affiliated with and participating in the creation of William Branham's ministry. William Branham historical research is an ongoing project to document and organize that research data for public usage. John now is the happily married father of three boys. His hobbies include music, art, video games, science fiction books, or movies, or documentaries, and when not writing, he relaxes by studying ancient world archaeology, geography, religion, and culture. A true intellectual. And here is John Collins now. It is a pleasure to have John Collins on with us today. You're going to be talking about something we haven't yet covered on the show, which is always very exciting to me to be able to go into a new area, even though the themes are kind of a thread through a lot of our podcasts about things getting weaponized, etc. People portraying themselves as something that they're not, etc. So there are a lot of things we've covered, but not with this level of specificity about this group and about your experience. And I know our conversation is going to take us in a lot of exciting directions. So I'd love you to take a moment and just introduce yourself, and then we'll start talking.
Well, first off, thanks for having me. I'm John Collins. I'm the founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And I have the Leaving the Message YouTube channel, where I publish a lot of my research information and video versions of the podcast. But I am a former cult member. I was raised in the William Branham Message cult of personality. My family was at the top of the cult. My grandfather, the pastor, the head pastor at Branham's Tabernacle in Jeffersonville, Indiana, for I think it was like 50 years, he was the pastor. And up until age 37, that's all that I knew, lived, breathed, and continually kept my mind focused on the cult until we were finally able to escape.
Wow. Okay. So, right. You know, I'm putting together something for people who are born and raised in groups, a kind of something that I'm hoping to be able to have out to the public fairly soon. But it brings with it its own challenges. I know about half, if not more, of my practice are people born and raised in groups where they weren't quite sure how the world worked outside. And it is a very difficult thing to suddenly feel like you're on a different planet and you need to interact in different ways and think about yourself in different ways. And so I want to make sure that we get to those challenges, because I think that's going to feel very much in line with a lot of the challenges that people have who are listening. I'm curious, first, if we can kind of dissect the idea of a message here, because it's called The Message, but it turned out that there are a lot of other messages. I am always looking for the overt and the covert. What was the overt message, and what were the covert messages? Let's start there.
Actually, that is a subject that drove me to my latest book. I wanted to know, why is it called The Message? Because like you said, there's so many different groups that use that phrase. And as I'm interviewing people for my podcast, I kept running across new people that they said, well, wait a minute, you called yours The Message. That's what we called ours, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned at the beginning of this the idea of weaponized religion. And I began to understand that every group that I examined that had the message as their theme, they also had weaponized religion as a practice. And I wanted to know why. Why is this? It drove me down paths of research that you can't even imagine, hours and hours in libraries with microfiche. I think at this point, I have probably read 200,000 to 300,000 newspaper articles. It takes a long time on microfiche, but thankfully, newspapers.com made this easier. And most, not all, but most that I read came from the online sources after they digitized it. But anyway.
People who are younger don't know the struggle of microfiche, card catalogs.
Oh, yeah.
All of it, right? Right, right, right. Okay, you guys have it easy. I mean, harder in some ways, but in this way, research, you have it easy. Yeah, okay, yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. I actually put together a video. This is kind of funny. Years ago, 2015, I was actually going to walk away from all of this and just say good riddance to it all. And I made this series of like documentary videos. Here's how I did what I did. Here's where I traveled. All of this, you know, all of the background to how I came to my conclusions. And there was one video where I was explaining how difficult it was to relearn how to use a microfiche machine. I have not used one in years, right? Fortunately, there was a lady at the library that helped me. And anyway, long story short, I started studying multiple threads of history and theology to get to the bottom of why is it called The Message. And one of the things that just there were multiple things that really troubled me about my past. One of them is that we were in a Pentecostal style cult that would take a phrase or passage from the Bible, rip it out of context completely, and then shove their own context into a single verse. In other words, if you read the text says something different. But when I read it, I would read, it's basically loaded language within the text of the Bible, if you really understand it. So I'm reading all of this loaded language within the Bible, and I wanted to know why. So I began studying and came across somewhere this reference to British Israelism, which is the notion that the United States and Canada were the descendants of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And as such, all of the blessings that applied to Israel in the Old Testament applied to the new modern church. And I was thinking about that and I was scratching my head because there were prophecies that never made sense to me, but within that context, it actually did. We were told that Nahum's prophecy was actually about Outer Drive in Chicago. And I'm thinking, well, how is that possible? It's about Nineveh. You can clearly see it reads about Nineveh, right? But under the British Israel context, that is exactly what it meant. Over time, this began to be adopted in the United States at the same time that racism was taking, it had been in the United States, but it's really starting to take hold in Christian identity. And I came across Michael Barkun's book, Religion and the Racist Right, I think it's called. He had all of the information that I did not have about the history of British Israelism's flow to Christian identity. I had all the information that he didn't have about how it was embedded into the Pentecostal Latter Rain movement. And he had two references, one to Charles Fox Parham, the father of Pentecostalism, and one to William Branham, who was the cult leader for my sect. And I had all the missing pieces, so I started filling them in chronologically. When I did, I started to notice that as British Israelism was coming into the United States and as it was taking shape with Christian identity, they began to call it the British Israel message. And I found a few different articles to that effect. When Pentecostalism was rebirthed in the late 1940s, they began to change it from the British Israel message to the Latter Rain message. And then it spawned off hundreds, if not thousands, of cults off of this Latter Rain message concept. Well, anybody who's in one of those cults would shorten what it is that they believe to just simply the message. So you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of these things.
Right. Amazing. It's incredible. So coming from a Jewish background, And I'm thinking of the book of Nahum, and as far as I remember, the limited that I should remember more after all the years I went to Hebrew school, but that there was a message for the Assyrians in it, right? So as far as I know, the Assyrians are not from England or United States. So here you have this kind of mashup, and you need to make sense of it. And then you make sense of it, and it sounds like then it changes to something else. So I don't even know how you play catch up and get to what's real, because it's already morphed into something else. It must feel like an endless challenge to try to understand, is there a kernel of truth in it? Is there not? You know?
Yeah, I sort of equate it to, I don't know if you're a fan of this, but I really, really liked Smallville back whenever it was on. And there are people who are in Smallville that went on to destructive cults, which is also interesting. The one in particular, Chloe, was my favorite character because she had the wall of weird, and she would have posted pictures with all of these strings tying it together to on her wall of weird. What I do is much like that, but combine it with the family circus drawing where, is it Billy? Going through all of those circles and those dotted lines, that's what it's like. There are so many trails that you can't logically make sense of it.
You know, sometimes people will say, how do really bright people get involved? I mean, you were born into it. So we're talking about people who have gotten involved in something later or who have worked to make something make sense. Because when you have a brain that's really functioning, it wants to ascribe logic to things. And if it's not there, you'll make it fit. Otherwise, you have this cognitive or spiritual dissonance, and that's way too uncomfortable. So I think people make it make sense until it doesn't anymore, which is a very difficult moment when it doesn't. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the message, and then I want to get to how you left and then the challenges of emerging into the world.
Yeah, so first let me address the cognitive dissonance. So I know I've worked with many, many people who have escaped the cults at this point, and some of them are quite intelligent people, and they all look at me and they say, John, how could I have been so stupid? And it actually goes beyond cognitive dissonance. So in a religious context, whenever you're going to church, you are expecting that the person on the platform is going to be giving you something that's truth. So if you're a carpenter and you work with your arms all week, you're swinging a hammer, on Sunday you're tired and you're sitting there, your arms are resting. Well, for people like me who are working with their brains all week, they go to church and their brains are resting. So you want to shut it down, you want to be calm, and you want to trust that the preacher is saying something that's true. And I came from a world where I discovered that the preachers were saying things that they knew were not true. But what happens is people sit into the services and they shut off all of their critical thinking. So you can have a really smart person who shuts off their critical thought, and some of them may even not even be fully paying attention, but what's being said is still going into their heads through their ears. So over time, what happens is they get indoctrinated without even being aware or critically thinking about the nonsense. I consider myself an intelligent person. I really do. We actually believe that Branham could speak squirrels into existence. That's one of the weird things that we believed. And afterwards, I'm like, well, there's no way, man. How was I convinced of that? But yet we were.
Mm-hmm. I found, and I don't know if you found this, that sometimes the weirder the thought is, the more people go for it because they think, well, who would make that up? I mean, it's so random. And it's so specific about squirrels. I'm just really wondering also what that's about. But right, it's like you're talking about autopilot, right? You just kind of go with it. But you're right, when there's repetition of ideas, you know, you have this false sense that maybe it's the truth, or it does get more deeply embedded just because of the repetition. That is a hard thing to fight against, actually, even subconsciously.
Absolutely. So back to your question, how did I escape? You know, it's funny, whenever I was in it, I would have actually taken a bullet for it. I would have died to defend the faith. And yet it was a doomsday cult. We believed that any moment that the world was going to end. So I had no desire to be in what we called the world, the outside world. As with all cults, it's a very much an us versus them mentality. So I lived in a world where, number one, my family was at the top. We were what I have come to call cult royalty. And with that comes all the prestige of being, I was proud to be a Collins, right? My grandfather's the head pastor. So I really had no need not to enjoy it. But at the same time, there are things that I think inwardly all people, whenever they are at rest and then their mind starts to think about the things that they believe, there are questions I think that people just bury and suppressed. I'm certain that I did. I had no reason for those to surface until it was around 2000 and I think 2011 when it started, but I started just being hit left and right with life-changing, horrifically severe, traumatic experiences, many of which I still, to this day, struggle trying to think through. And from time to time, I go to therapy to try to unravel that. But things like family members who just nearly died of cancer and just so many things, and it really shook me. And when you're in that state where you're just so broken and beaten down, your mind suddenly can't suppress all of your thoughts. And I think that's really what happened. I had this sudden explosion of thoughts. So for everybody who I'm working with, and they've gone through this long journey of trying to come to terms with, is it true, is it not? And there's this long, extensive journey where they really struggle to escape. My mind just suddenly snapped. I can't explain it, but I clearly remember this moment. I was reading the Bible. I read the Bible every day, and I was reading this one chapter, and I was so just traumatized with all of the things that were hitting me. I had forgotten what I had read the night before, so I went back and read the previous chapter, and as I'm reading it, I'm starting to recall what I had read, and suddenly the words, the loaded meanings behind each phrase suddenly wasn't there. And the chapter said something different than I had read the night before. And so it was a night and day, black or white, just sudden difference. But yet I still believed the cult. And I was struggling with it. We were kind of, I don't know how to explain it. We were in a place where we weren't really satisfied with the church that my grandfather led, mostly because of our children. The services were incredibly long. In the Branham Tabernacle, we would listen to recordings from 1947 to 1965 of William Branham every Sunday, twice on Sunday, every Wednesday, and sometimes on Saturdays on special events. So picture yourself getting dressed up in the full Sunday go-to-meeting garb, going and sitting in these hard, uncushioned pews for an hour and a half to 2 hours. One of the sermons, I think, is 2.5 hours long, which was kind of okay, but now picture it with small children. And as you entered into the Branham Tabernacle, this is a memory I also will never forget. You would walk into the foyer and you would hear some kid being beaten for not being able to sit in the pew, just spanked constantly. And it was like if you went during the service, you always heard this. And I would never do this to my child. What I would do instead was I would take them out to the car. And I don't think everybody knew this, but there was a short signal radio broadcast of this recording that's being played. So I would go out to the car and I'd listen to it with my child, and we would listen in comfort and then go back in. But over time, as you're doing this, you're starting to think, well, this just doesn't feel right. I want to go hear some actual live preaching. So we were on a journey just literally to find another cult church in this area, which there were a few. And each one we went to had different doctrines. And I find myself on the search for truth, not knowing that I'm on a search for truth.
So interesting. Right. And the truth, that's another, I mean, talking about the word message, the word truth, right, is used like, what's your truth? What's your truth? I one time talked about this on the podcast. Even the idea of God is like, who is your God and who is your God? There was one of my first cult conferences for people who had been involved in cults, and I was there as a therapist, and some of my clients were there for the first time. There was a group discussion about people who had been in a variety of different, very fringe Bible-based cultic groups, and someone put together a pin that said, "My God can beat up your God." And it was just the kind of the ridiculousness of it all, right? The other idea about snapping, it's interesting. I remember a book from years ago, I think it's out of print, by Conway and Siegelman called that snapping. It just kind of snapping into something, snapping out of it, where it just, you reach this crescendo, using a music reference, and you can't ignore it anymore because it just shifts you, like the seismic kind of shift. I love hearing the story, though, about you taking your child out and listening in comfort. I mean, so many of these groups know nothing about child development and what's appropriate and how long kids can sit and what is good behavior, bad behavior, all of the things that, you know, you're held up to a certain standard. And the behavior modification of walking in and hearing a child being hit or hurt or crying out or whatever they were doing, that will make you sit still. But still, it's not developmentally appropriate to expect it. But groups like this, most groups, religious groups, other groups that are so strict, often don't take into account what a child really needs. And I love that you made that modification that was kind for your child until, you know, you decided to leave. That's very nice to hear.
And it was actually that thought that ultimately led me out of the cult. So we started attending all of these other churches, and there's a yearly gathering at one of the churches in Macon, Georgia. So I told my family, we're going to go, we're going to visit. I had spent a large part of my life in Warner Robins, Georgia, which was right next to Macon. So we went to a church that I had been in before, but it had grown extensively since the last time I had visited. They had new building, multiple floors. The sanctuary was quite large. They had video and all of the modern equipment. So I walk in, we sit down, and it's the same thing. It's this long, long service that your kid just can't sit through. So about halfway through, I take him downstairs where they had a room for the people to take, the men to take their children, which was unusual for the cult. Well, I walk into this room, and here's this nice plush leather couch. There's this playpen just filled with toys, Legos all over the floor, a recliner, and probably a 50-inch TV. And TV was tuned into the service. I mean, this was really highly unusual for the cult. It really was. Usually, this was a task for the women. I always viewed men and women equally. That's just how I was wired, even though that also is kind of against the cult doctrine. I was doing it to give my wife some rest while, you know, taking care of the unruly kid. Well, I go down here, and this is unusual. So I turn on the TV, and here's the service. I kick back in the recliner, the kids on the floor playing Legos, and suddenly I find myself watching the service outside of the atmosphere of the service, and I'm watching it on a television, and I'm seeing the energy of the minister, very charismatic sermon, that's how they all are, very, I want to use the word offensive, it's very offensive, some of the things that they say. They like to target something and just be very offensive towards it. Which is all, that's another thing that's always been against my personality. So I'm listening to this and I'm suddenly seeing it from a different view because I don't feel the excitement of the crowd around me. It's just me and my boy playing Legos. And suddenly I notice the things that he's saying. I'm starting to pick up on techniques that I just have learned over time of how you can manipulate people. And I say that somewhat with experience because I had done to limited extent some sales for my business. And so I knew how all this worked. You can actually, in some sometimes healthy ways, manipulate a person to agree that you have the best product ever. And there are techniques that you can do, verbal techniques. And I'm watching this, but I'm watching it from a religious standpoint. He's using religious techniques that there was a line I would never cross when I was doing sales, but he was crossing those lines. And I'm starting to notice it on television. I'm getting a little uncomfortable with it. And then as the hype grows and the excitement grows, I'm watching him feed on the crowd as the crowd is feeding on him. And I began, like, I'm fully dissecting what's happening as I'm sitting there in the room with my kid playing Legos on the floor. And it was at that moment I realized that all of this hype and all of this energy seems so fake. Why am I in this fake religion? That's the thought that hit me.
Wow. That is really fascinating. And yes, there's so much about sales that I think about, and I talk on the podcast sometimes about Robert Cialdini, who talks about, you know, the influence, techniques of influence. And he spoke at a cult conference saying, they're all here. And this is what we do in business. This is what happens in a cult. And then his book after the one about how to persuade people was this idea of persuasion, that you can put them into this kind of way of being open to whatever message you're going to have, or the fact that someone is standing up by a dais or has a microphone, that you already are, you know, able to think that they are open to the idea that they are speaking the truth. So then you're going to be open to the message. One of the things that happened so often during COVID was that people then couldn't go to certain things, and that distance, even though you were there, you were in the building, but the distance from the environment was what helped them really see, like having, like I talk about wanting to take a good landscape photo, that you have to step back, you have to step away to see the whole thing. It's fascinating. And so here I'm thinking of your kid being like, la, 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 doing his thing, and you're having this moment. Oh my goodness. That is incredible. And so then what happened after that?
Well, after that, I began to do a deep dive of just examining what I believed and why. And honestly, to that point, I really did not recognize the many critical flaws with what I believe. Internally, all of the doctrines that we had were in conflict, but I thought it was this cohesive thing that was God's message to the end times people of the earth, right? So I had no idea that it could even be conflicting. And I discovered a book and a little blog that somebody had started that was just asking a few questions and posing some possible problems with it. I began looking at it and I'm like, oh my gosh, man, how did I not pick up on this stuff? I read the Bible daily. I knew what was in the Bible. I had listened to the sermons daily. When I was in high school, while all of the other kids are listening to rock and roll and having parties and having fun, I'm listening to my Walkman with this screaming voice from the 1950s preaching at me on the bus, in my car, whenever I was able to drive, everywhere I went. At night, I would go to sleep listening to these things. So I knew the Bible inside out, and I actually knew these 1,200 sermons inside and out from Branham. And I had yet never picked up on things like his father was supposed to have died at an early age, which was why he was allegedly not educated. And so he got a seventh grade education, I think he said. And so that's why he had this hillbilly accent and all of this stuff. And then in other sermons, I was aware of that, but I was also aware at the same time that he preached his father's funeral at a much later age. So I knew both of those things, and my brain had just never connected the two to say that, no, you can't preach your father's funeral if he died whenever you're in seventh grade. That doesn't work. And that's just one of, we've probably identified 1,000 things like this. And I started going through trying to chronologue all of the history as I could piece it together. And I began the journey of going into the newspapers, articles through the microfiche in the library. I spent so much time in the courthouse digging through courthouse records that they knew me on first name basis. And it was funny because over time there was this shift in security where you had to tell people what you were doing, why you were there. So I'd watch these people walk into the building and they're having to fill out all these forms. I would walk up and they'd say, hi, John, come on in. And I knew everybody on a first name basis. You can't even do that now, which is kind of funny. But at that point of time, I could. So I start saving everything onto files, not knowing what I would be doing today. I wish I had have kept everything a lot more organized than I did. But I kept coming back to that thought about how the crowds were manipulated, because I'm still in shock that I can be that smart of a person and believe that this man could speak squirrels into existence, and also that he had a magic sword. That's one of the other things we believed. He had a magic sword. I was on a business trip for one of my clients. I flew into Raleigh, North Carolina. And on the way back, I just happened to sit next to a psychologist who was probably famous. I think he had written a book. I wish I had remembered his name. But I'm describing my story to him on the flight back, and he's just fascinated. And he says, John, there's a few books that you need to read. And he gave me a list. I won't give you the whole list. But the most important one is Propaganda by Edward Bernays. I read the book Propaganda, and it changed my life, man. I'm reading this, and I'm starting to understand play by play what they did to my head, how they did it, why they did it, and everything that is being described for mass manipulation of crowds and propaganda was being done in the church.
I'm wondering then about leaving, about moving into the world that was not going to be existing for very long, right? And not that that's how I see it, but, you know, end time, you know, groups see it that way. And so you needed to make your way already as a parent, needing to learn as you were teaching, playing those roles, you know, simultaneously. I'm sure that was quite a challenge. So tell me about those challenges when you first came out. What do you remember being, maybe being easier than you thought or being harder than you thought?
Oh, it was crazy hard. Every single aspect of life I was completely unfamiliar with. Simple, basic things like, so I'm now 50 years old. Maybe 5 years ago, I didn't have any retirement at all. Because if you're in an end-of-the-world doomsday cult, you don't save for retirement. That's one of the things that you just don't simply don't do. Why would you need it, right? So I'm having to piece together my life for planning for the future. There were ways that we were indoctrinated, specifically with regards to children, which you hinted at a bit, but it goes much deeper than just simply the corporal punishment. The way that you train a child is worse than you would train a dog. And I began to understand that you can't treat children the way that we treated them in the cult. But then at the same time, that's how I was raised. I was raised with a rod, you know, and you will do what I say because I said it and you will not question it. Well, a kid is filled with questions. If you don't answer their questions, you're hindering their growth. So now I'm faced with going outside of my element, you know, trying to learn how do I raise my kids in the right way. Every aspect of life began to change. And at the same time, I'm so filled with questions. What happened to me? Why did this happen? I dove even further into the research. I wanted to know what was this and why. We were told that it was such a tiny group. We are the small elect. I suddenly came into realization that as the foremost leader of the post-World War II healing revival, this was a massive thing, not a tiny thing. It had eventually evolved into a somewhat small destructive group, but while being advertised as small, there were 3 to 4 million people in it worldwide, which is not small by any numbers. So I just started simply going through the history and started back at the beginning based off of what Branham said was his history. And none of his histories lined up. None of them were coherent. So I started diving deeper into the newspaper articles, trying to piece together. And suddenly I came across the information that the Kardashian family had sponsored the whole thing. And I'm like, I've heard that name, the Kardashians. I was so far disconnected from reality in the cult, I did not know who the Kardashians were. So the first thing is to study, okay, who are the Kardashians? And I'm like, oh my gosh. And, you know, tied to the entertainment business. And then here they have created an entertainment gospel. And the patriarchs, I think it's his nephew, Dimas Shakarian, founded the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship International, which was one of the primary sponsors for Branhamism. And even after all of the churches had sort of severed themselves from Branham, they continued to sponsor his ministry. So I'm wondering why. And back to the weaponized religion theme, I keep finding pieces of information that just really don't fit, but it does from a governmental standpoint. If you have a government mission to do something and use religion as the vehicle, there's certain things that you would expect, and I started to see those things, one of which was the campaign manager for William Branham was the Baron William T. Freire von Blumberg, who was the adopted cousin of Hitler's Minister of Defense, who was a director in the Fellowship International, the family cult, if you're familiar with that, the ones who were deeply, deeply embedded in Washington. And there are declassified documents wondering whether or not he was a spy, because as he's posing as this big religious figure, even when directly questioned, he had no interest in religion. So you're wondering, well, why is he sponsoring this? And he's having male escorts into his hotel, almost gets caught with one. And so every piece of this, none of it's making any sense. So I started to deeply dive into, now I'm studying government history, world history, mythologies, theology. And my studies were so vast that there was a period of time I wasn't really able to run my business. And I actually had some of my employees running my business as I would go study. So this turned into just more than a full-time job. It was like two full-time jobs of just researching to understand what was this I was in and why. And the deeper I dug, the more spider webs of different cults it was creating and different just unbelievable conspiracies. The Nazis were escaping from Germany into Argentina, and they were landing in a colony called Colonia Dignidad, which was created because of this cult. And it was created by the cult leader who founded that colony. He was William Branham's security detail in Germany, established through the Baron William T. Freire von Blumberg, who's tied to the German elites. And all of this is starting to make some sense, but yet not from a religious standpoint. And the things like that that I came across, some of them were quite dangerous. I can't even talk about some of the things that happened because of this. I've had meetings where we had to drop all of our cell phones into a box and then go off somewhere into the field where there can be no technology. The things that you uncover are just unbelievable, none of which really are tied to religion. So as I'm dealing with trying to establish myself in a new world, in a new non-cult world, where my family is being given everything that they need to survive as they get older, I'm now finding myself disconnected from reality again, just trying to figure out what is this mess.
Wow, that is incredible. I'm thinking of Simon Wiesenthal and how he found these little pockets in, you know, Argentina. I had no idea. And Simon Wiesenthal, for people who don't know, is this one of the more famous Nazi hunters, and made it his life's mission.
He is the one who identified Joseph Mengele in the compound.
Oh my, I just got chills.
And it's and unbelievable.
What is the name of the place again in Argentina where they were?
It's Colonia Dignidad. It's actually in Chile. They would go into Chile. Oh. If you watch, there's a show on, I think it's the National Geographic Channel, Hitler's Hunters or something. They do a full episode of the labyrinth of tunnels under this thing. But I had an interview on my podcast with the foremost expert of Colonia Dignidad from the university that's in that area. And he has dug in ways that just blew my mind. He said, John, did you know that they were producing sarin gas, and that during the Iran-Contra affair, the elites who were tied to all of the weapons production, many of the weapons were being produced in this colony. And he started showing me the weapons caches and sent me news articles that were in different languages, and I'm translating them. He said, John, do you remember the gun from The Man with the Golden Gun? I said, yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. He said, they had that actual gun there. They actually had the gun with the cigarette lighter and the pen, and they had facilities that you could only reach by helicopter. You had to go up onto the cliff, just like they did in the Bond movies. And the technology in this facility was immense, because the colony, Colonia Dignidad, Colonia means colony, from the surface, it looked like this ordinary Pentecostal-y type commune. You would think of it like today, the Amish. It looked like an Amish community. They're singing praises to Jesus and Branham and other weird stuff. But underneath, they had this labyrinth of torture chambers. And they were basically, the whole facility was being set up to overthrow the government, Augusto Pinochet. They wanted to install Augusto Pinochet. And so they were working directly with DINA. And this facility was training the American DIA, which is the military equivalent of the CIA, was working with the Chileans to teach them how to do espionage. And they were conducting all of the training within this facility and bringing in all of the people who were opposing them and torturing them below. So on the surface, you've got this shiny, happy people, and then below is just unbelievable what's going on. And you can listen to the podcast on my channel, but my mind was blown. Like, I didn't even know what to say to that.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. This is incredible. You know, just the cover-up, the pretending, again, to be something that you're not. It's reminding me of when, you know, people checking on what was happening in the concentration camps would go in and they would have the children singing in a choir, you know, and their parents had just been shot, but they had to sing in front of these people and smile or they were going to get shot. I mean, it gets very dark, very dark. And so darker than we probably want to get into today, but it is very dark. And that is incredible that these governments were also sanctioning this or protecting these people. And that's so beyond shameful. My goodness. So the idea, though, of a cover-up is interesting, and it leads us into, you know, your being connected to the story and the media reaching out to you and how difficult it might be to get this information out and what hinders it and how hard that really is. I mean, it leaves people blind, I think, that they don't know what's happening right around them or under or in tunnels, you know? So I'm curious how it's been for you just to come forward with this story and what the challenges have been.
So this movement, it was the post-World War II healing revival. It was the Latter-rain message. It eventually evolved into just simply the message. And people like T.L. Osborne, who's a Word of Faith hero, was involved with this. People like Oral Roberts, Oral Roberts University was involved with this. John Osteen, Joel Osteen's father, was part of this. So many different names in today's charismatic movement that you look at it and you think, well, all of these people can't be part of this Branhamite commune system, right? What is this mess? Well, the deeper I dig, the more I find that actually they were, and it's a much bigger mess than people realize. But each thread of history that I examine, if you look forward, going backward in time, you're going to find a point at which they all erase their histories. T.L. Osborne was very famous. You can see him on the TBN channel, the guy with the big curly handlebar mustaches. At William Branham's memorial service, he said, "We have just seen today God in the flesh." I've got the research on my website. You can read his statement for himself. He says, "Now, some people are going to think that I'm a little sacrilegious, but here was God in the flesh." And I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he said. That's at the memorial service at a Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship meeting. Again, the Full Gospel Businessmen is connected to the Kardashian family. So this is an entertainment gospel meeting. Kenneth Hagin was very close to T.L. Osborne. They started the Word of Faith movement. John Osteen, obviously in the Prosperity Gospel movement. All of these movements began to create all of these apostolic networks that eventually C. Peter Wagner began to label as the New Apostolic Reformation, and churches like International House of Prayer in Kansas City. So I mentioned Colonia Dignidad, I mentioned the guy from Germany. In that meeting in Germany with the guy who started Colonia Dignidad, William Branham, and Hitler's adopted cousin of Hitler's Minister of Defense, was a man by the name of Paul Kane, who was deeply embedded into the Kansas City Fellowship, who was a founding member of what would become the International House of Prayer in Kansas City, and basically one of the pillars of the New Apostolic Reformation. So if you trace all of these history, there is a common intersection between all of it, and it sadly intersects with William Branham and the nonsense that was being generated where people were believing he had a magic sword. So if you go to any of these ministries and you ask them, did you guys really believe he had a magic sword? They'll all tell you no, but there was a point in time in which I think many of them believe some weird stuff and they just won't admit it.
Right. It's hard to admit. But people do believe it, or they want to believe it, or they feel like they have to, because if they don't, then the house of cards starts to fall. So I'm curious also, there's been some events, you know, in parts of the United States that I wanted you to be able to touch on with in terms of the link to this particular group. And also just how, again, going back to how hard it is for us to find out this information. I mean, you had to dig. And now people have access to a lot of different media outlets everywhere, but still they might not be covering this.
So you're probably referring to Vance Belter. There are a few newspaper articles, I think some media reports, talking about his connection to Christ for the Nations. And they're fully missing the depth of it, because they simply found some preaching video where he's talking. I think he's preaching with somebody at Christ for the Nations, and they don't really understand the history of it. So what was Christ for the Nations? Christ for the Nations was the training center for the deliverance ministries as the charismatic movement began to grow. It was founded by Gordon Lindsay, and Gordon Lindsay was a key figure in the development of the charismatic movement. Gordon Lindsay was also William Branham's campaign manager. In the early years, in the 1940s, Gordon Lindsay was a keynote speaker at several Christian identity conferences, and he was preaching Christian identity to the masses. So he's part of spreading what the themes that would develop into today's Christian nationalism, Christian identity, many, many different things that are just insidious. The neo-Nazis came out of this movement. There are so many bad things. Not to say that he was a neo-Nazi or anything like this, but he was part of the fundamental development of that movement. Fast forward to the late 1940s, he becomes William Branham's campaign manager. He starts publishing this propaganda machine called The Voice of Healing. It was a publication that was started by William Branham to promote Branham's ministries. Gordon Lindsay had the vision to see the power of this, where you can create hero worship by inviting all of these different ministers to say whatever squirrels that they created or whatever angels they saw. And you can read through it. There are boys reading with a plastic eyeball. I mean, there's some weird, weird things in here. So it was this propaganda machine that developed into a conference surrounding the hype of the propaganda machine. So these conferences began to emerge, these Voice of Healing conferences. Many ministers, you can see photographs online of the hundreds, if not thousands, of ministers, evangelists coming to this thing. Jim Jones was part of this movement, People's Temple. He was deeply embedded to Branhamism, which was a shock. Hobart Freeman, the cult in Indiana, most of his congregants, not most, but a lot of his congregants died because he was forbidding them medicine. He was attending the Voice of Healing conferences, the deliverance training. Towards the end of Branham's life, they tried to turn it into a denomination and started holding deliverance training seminars. So they're teaching people the art of casting out demons. I call it Harry Potterism. It's like they're teaching all of these young Harry Potters how to speak. And I wish I'd have got it out for this interview, but I have a training manual on how to do deliverance ministry. And it's everything from, like, if you have the hiccups, it's because you have this evil spirit you need to cast out. And I'm thinking, I didn't know hiccups were like that. But they're teaching this kind of thing, right? Branham dies, and then Gordon Lindsay turns the deliverance training seminars into a school, and the school eventually developed into Christ for the Nations. And not just Vance Belter, but many, many people are connected and affiliated with this. Robert Morris, who has recently went to prison for all of the sexual misconduct, I have in their 20th, is it the 20th? The 50th year anniversary of Christ for the Nations, big write-up on Robert Morris, who's proud to announce that he is taking many Christ for the Nations graduates and putting into his gateway church because of the strong ties to it. Daystar Television, their advertising, it's so many different ministries are connected to it. So if you ask any of them, is this rooted in Christian identity? I actually have letters from the organization themselves who deny it. They say, Gordon Lindsay was never part of this. and we don't sell the books that he wrote on Christian identity in our bookstore. And yet, he wrote the books. So there's this question that exists that nobody will answer. And I understand why. If you have that dark and sinister of a past, you don't want people to know about it.
No. I find it always fascinating to see who was connected to whom and who was influenced by whom that we just really didn't know. And it is incredible to see the overlap. And it is, the fact that you were blown away by so much of what you uncovered, it's chilling. I've been blown away by what you've talked about today. And I really appreciate you kind of bringing this to light, that there are people who have been able to kind of stay in the shadows in terms of the evil that they have promoted, made possible, disseminated, and to get people, like you were talking about, sort of get, similar to Hitler, where they talk about his rallies, being a place where people had their hearts racing and they were charged up, and that sometimes when he really wanted to get the masses, he would do these nighttime rallies with, you know, these bonfires, and it just looked very dramatic. And so you can see, even in, you know, to a smaller degree, how that can happen within charismatic religious organizations all the way to political movements. And it really is very chilling how much we as human beings are prone to this. And it's really good that we recognize that in ourselves. I so appreciate you spending time with us today and teaching us so much. And I wish you well. And I'm sure you're going to be uncovering even more because you're a researcher. So thank you again, really. This has been incredible.
Well, thanks for having me. So many more things I could say, and it's really hard to contain all of it to 1 hour. It really is.
Right. Okay. Well, anytime you want to come back, let us know.
Awesome.
One more thing before you go. I am so happy to speak to people like John Collins, who has done so much research and who can speak from his heart, who can speak from his own experience, but also has been able to pool so much that is so important, so disturbing and devastating, and also just very empowering. Very empowering for the people who have been involved, who have now a greater understanding of what took place and why they were taught what they were taught. It is so devastating to be a part of a doomsday cult, to be a part of a doomsday anything. I talk to so many people who say, I never planned my future because I just didn't know if I was going to have one. I didn't know if the world was going to be here. And so I don't have a college degree, so I never learned how to do certain things, or I never started a family. And so they have their life on hold because they just didn't know if they were going to continue having a life. When we also talk about situations like this kind of church and Pentecostal kinds of churches, but specifically with William Branham, we have this environment that's been curated to be so intense, to be so manipulative. And I think about John Hunter's book, Manufacturing Mania. If you have a chance to read it, please do. It describes so much of these moments where people feel so swept up into something that they feel like this is their life and this is their level of fervor that they want to be able to feel all the time because they feel so alive. They feel so awake and they feel so engaged. But when you're dealing with manufactured fervor, when you're dealing with manufactured mania, then what you have is something that didn't necessarily originate from inside of you. It doesn't mean you're excited about it. It means they made you excited about it. And sometimes you don't know if it's something you really feel, if it's something you really believe in, until you step away from it something I know I had talked to John about, and this is something that comes up a lot, that while COVID was very difficult for the world, for people who were being raised during that time, for kids who didn't get a chance to go to school their formative years, their first years of life, or like one of my kids who turned 16 right at the beginning of COVID and could have been going out and doing a lot of things with her friends, but she couldn't and she was sequestered at home. It changes your existence for a period of time. But while it was hard and there were deaths and it was devastating and scary, for other people, it was the thing that helped to wake them up. Because while there were many church groups that said they didn't believe in COVID and that if you got it, that was, you know, because the devil was working through you or that was God's punishment. Okay, fine. So there was that whole group of people. At the same time, there were some people who were too sick because of having gotten COVID to go to a church service, or they were home caring for their loved ones or in the hospital with loved ones who may or may not have made it through their COVID diagnosis and illness. And that time away actually helped to wake them up. It helped them to see that they didn't feel the same intensity as soon as they were outside the system. And they didn't feel the draw or the need to go back as much as they thought. Now, churches knew that for some people, this was going to be the end of people's alliance and real dedication. And so people were given the task to call members of churches who weren't showing up, to call them relentlessly, to make sure that they came back. And if they didn't, and if they weren't planning to come back, to raise the bar by making them feel fearful of not coming back, of what could happen to them, etc. And actually, a lot of church groups used this whole idea of COVID to be something that people could be talked into feeling like, okay, if I don't go back, I'm not going to be protected. The only way I'm going to have God's protection is if I am doing what God wants me to do, which I guess, according to that church, meant going back to that church. But when I've talked to people over the years who have left large group awareness trainings because they were exhausted or they were, God forbid, in a car accident or they got very ill or they couldn't go to visit this person who they were dating, who they were wondering if that person was manipulative or dangerous to them. And because they had COVID, they couldn't go or they were needing to stay at home. They actually had this feeling of a spell being broken. So while I am not suggesting anyone get sick for this purpose of self-protection, you want to build something into your connection to something new, your connection to someone new. If you're feeling caught up in it, if you're feeling addicted to it, if you're feeling addicted to them, if you're feeling scared that unless you see them every night, something is going to happen or they're going to choose someone else, and so you have to see them. If there's something that is making your heart race, either with excitement or with fear, but either way, there's the expectation or the need for you to keep coming back, make sure you don't, even for an hour, even for an evening, even hopefully for a day or two, and see how you feel after that. See if you still are either missing that person or you're just actually feeling scared of not going back because you're afraid you're going to get into trouble or you're afraid you're going to be threatened with something. That's not the same as falling in love. That's not the same as devotion. That's not the same as being enamored with something. That's not the same as something really being important and necessary in your life. That is just being made to feel scared. And believing that somehow you're now going to be under threat if you don't go back. That is never a good reason to get involved in something new and devote yourself to something new. That is a way for you to make sure, though, that your blood pressure is going to be high, that your fears are going to be used and abused, and that your happiness and your safety is never going to be important to them. It needs to be important to you. So weave in taking a little bit of a break, even if you need to come up with an excuse. You also don't even need to come up with an excuse. You shouldn't have to justify why you need a night off. And in fact, it can be diagnostic that if an organization or a church or a person needs for you to explain yourself, if you're canceling coming to a service or meeting up for a date, and it has to be a good enough excuse, that's reason enough to not go back. Take good care. Stay safe out there. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.